to form a very close team to make sure that we work on everything that we've talked about, moving the state forward.
Governor-elect Mike Dunleavy announces his transition team. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 8th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, this year's whaling season comes to an end in Ukiagvik.
It's just what puts us together is the whale, the bowhead whale. Just gets us all together.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's the time of year for people on Medicare to consider changes to their current Medicare prescription drug coverage. Plan designs can change, and new plans may be available, so it's important for you to do an annual review of your plan. Open enrollment for Medicare Part D has started and will last until December the 7th. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message sponsored by Alaska Department of Health and Social Services and this station.
Governor-elect Mike Dunleavy told mining industry leaders today that Alaska is open for business. He also named Alaska Republican Party Chairman Tuckerman Babcock to be his chief of staff and chairman of the transition team. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchiman reports on Dunleavy's first public appearance since Election Day.
Dunleavy says he's known Babcock for a long time and trusts him. Dunleavy also named his former campaign manager, Brett Huber, as his senior policy advisor. And he says he'll be looking for smart, hardworking people to serve as commissioners. Dunleavy's voice was hoarse from a cold that began the last day of the campaign.
We're going to work closely together. We're going to form a very close team to make sure that we work on everything that we've talked about and moving the state forward. Resource development, public safety, restoring trust in the permanent fund, the issue of the permanent fund, making sure that we have jobs and opportunity for everyone.
Dunleavy told the Alaska Miners Association annual convention that he will work to encourage developing Alaska's natural resources. Dunleavy notes that his own family, including his daughters, have worked at Red Dog Mine in the Northwest Arctic Borough.
So you're going to have to put on your seatbelts because this is not going to be a slow crawl. We're going to pick up speed here real fast. We're going to be working with the industry across the board. And we're going to be working internally in my administration to make sure that when we start to look at fines and possibilities, that the attitude is, I don't know, maybe not. The attitude is going to be, how can we make this happen?
Dunleavy answered questions from reporters after his speech about how he'll approach different policies. Dunleavy says the state will be able to pay out full permanent fund dividends under the formula used until PFDs were cut the last 3 years. Dunleavy says he's interested in transferring some Alaska state land to private ownership.
We are working on some ideas regarding land. We have 100 million acres of land. Very little of it's in private hands. And we got to make a decision as a state as to what we want to do with our own state land.
Dunleavy says he expects to put his own stamp on the state budget that will be introduced 2 weeks after his December 1st swearing in. And Dunleavy describes how his administration will approach Medicaid.
Review it, see how we can improve upon it, make sure that it's sustainable. Take a real hard look at Medicaid to see if we can something we can sustain for it. Everybody wants something, we know that. But if we're not able to sustain programs, I think it's kind of a disappointment for the people of Alaska to rely on something that we can't sustain.
Dunleavy says he'll work with Governor Bill Walker on a smooth transition. Babcock says the transition team will announce Friday how Alaskans can give their ideas for the new administration. With help from Nat Herz in Anchorage, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The representative identified as the next Speaker of the Alaska House lacks the necessary 21 votes to be elected to the post, at least according to an interview with one of his colleagues. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Nat Herz reports.
Wasilla GOP Representative David Eastman says he's not ready to vote for Dave Tallarico of Healy, who Republicans announced yesterday as the next House Speaker. Republicans said at a news conference that they have 21 members of a new majority that will take power back from the largely Democratic group that controls the House right now. But there were only 20 people in the room. Eastman was missing. Without Eastman's vote for Tallarico, House Republicans only have 20, which is not enough to elect a speaker in the 40-member chamber. Eastman says he intends to vote for a Republican as Speaker, but he wants to have a better feel for a candidate's priorities and agenda before agreeing to vote for them. Eastman is about to start his second two-year term in the House. In his first term, he was known for taking far-right, uncompromising positions on the state budget and social issues like abortion. His stance on Tallarico casts doubt on the strength of the 21-member majority caucus, in which opposition from a single member could undercut the group's ability to pass legislation. It's also still not guaranteed that the majority will even have 21 members. One Republican, Bart Laban of Fairbanks, has a narrow 79-vote lead over his Democratic opponent. Elections officials say they don't know how many absentee and other ballots still need to be counted in that district. One of the leaders of the new group of Republicans, Anchorage Representative Lance Pruitt, says he's still confident the GOP will have at least 21 votes for Tallarico when the time comes. Pruitt says Eastman is going to vote for a Republican, and Tallarico is the Republican that the party's members are supporting. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
The Trump administration is offering substantially less land for oil leasing in the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, or NPRA, than it did last year. At its annual oil and gas lease sale, the Bureau of Land Management will offer 254 tracts for bid. That's close to 3 million acres of the federally managed reserve, which is west of Prudhoe Bay. Last year, the Trump administration put 900 tracts up for bid. That was the most land ever offered to oil and gas companies in the reserve. But last year's sale attracted little interest. Oil companies only bid on 7 tracts. Still, NPRA is seeing a surge of oil development led by ConocoPhillips. The company is pursuing several large projects in the northeastern part of the reserve. Environmental groups have sued the federal government, challenging 2 previous oil lease sales in NPRA. In a statement, the Center for Biological Diversity said climate change is already underway in Alaska, and this lease sale will only make it worse. This year's NPRA oil lease sale will be held on December 12th. The results of the House District 35 race were delayed on election night due to a technical issue in voting across Southeast. But election returns are finally in for Sitka, Petersburg, and other communities affected by the malfunction. As of 3 p.m. Thursday, Democratic incumbent Jonathan Christ Tompkins leads Republican challenger Richard Wien by almost 670 votes, with 85% of precincts reporting. Results from 3 precincts, Craig, Klawak, and Thorne Bay, were yet to be uploaded to the Alaska Division of Elections website. Over 2,600 Sitkins voted in person on Election Day, the biggest community in the district. Petersburg saw 940 voters in person on Election Day, supporting Christ Tompkins with 58% of the vote. In Sitka, Christ Tompkins received 55% of the vote. Christ Tompkins felt it was unlikely that returns in those other 4 communities would change the results of the election.
Given their size, it's seemingly mathematically improbable that things can really change all that much from the current margin. So feeling good and like it's at least partial punctuation on the election.
Richard Wien did not return KCAW's call for comment on the latest election results. Voters in Petersburg largely followed how the state as a whole voted, supporting Congressman Don Young with 52% of the vote and Governor-elect Mike Dunleavy with 49%. But the same is not true in Sitka. 6 in 10 voters in both of Sitka's precincts supported Elise Galvin for Congress, and Mark Begich, Dunleavy's Democratic challenger in the race for governor, won about 56% of Sitkin's votes. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a 9,000-year-old tooth holds intriguing clues to life in ancient Alaska.
I did actually hold the sample when I was in Copenhagen. Yeah, it's a thrill to hold something like that in your hand.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska wants to remind residents that open enrollment for individual and family health plans is now through December 15th. Many Alaskans qualify for a tax credit on their premiums to help lower the cost of coverage, and according to a study by KF Foundation, average tax credits for Alaskans who qualified in 2017 were over $700 a month. Learn more and estimate your tax credit at primera.com. This message sponsored by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska.
Over half of the Tongass National Forest is federally protected from road construction. The so-called roadless rule has been in place since 2001 and the subject of nearly continuous litigation since then. But now the state has petitioned the Forest Service to craft an Alaska-specific rule that would make way for economic development in the Tongass. KCAW's Emily Kwong reports on why many in Sitka want the roadless rule and the trees it protects to stay untouched.
The scene is a square conference table in the Yaw Arts Building, windows facing a darkening forest. Seated around the table are the 12 members of the Roadless Rule Committee, appointed by Governor Bill Walker. And they're taking comments from the public, all of whom call for non-action. Some are from Sitka, some from Prince of Wales Island, others are calling in over the phone from Klawock and Tenneke Springs. Those commenting are saying they want to maintain prohibitions for road building in specific areas of the Tongass, essentially blocking development for logging and mining. Clarice Johnson's grandfather was a logger during the heyday of old-growth timber when cutting down old trees was good economics. Johnson told the committee that times have changed.
Eliminating the roadless rule will not bring back the logging industry. It will only endanger the other drivers of the Southeast economy.
Drivers for Johnson include tourism and fishing, which rely on intact watersheds and roadless areas. Jeff Arndt pointed out that logging makes up a far smaller portion of the economy than it once did.
Timber contributes less than 1% to the jobs in the economy of Southeast Alaska compared to about 25% for fishing and tourism.
Bethany Goodrich reasoned that Southeast entrepreneurship, from wildlife viewing charters to a kelp salsa business, needs a Tongass without roads.
People are not intrigued by Alaskan products because of clear cuts and conflict. My clients aren't asking me to brand them as embedded in a timber farm. Through their businesses, they want to share their identity, their culture, their cherished home with the world and with their customers. And I am not anti-timber, but I resent that the timber industry feels like the monofocus that drives our land management decisions today.
Some comments did support responsible hydroelectric development. Others simply felt the Tongass needed as many trees in the ground as possible to sequester carbon emissions. The 12 members of the advisory committee took all of this in, some scribbling down notes. State Forester Chris Mache is a part of the committee, too. The rest have some kind of commercial or ecological interest in the Tongass. And their mandate from Governor Bill Walker is to submit a report of what an Alaska-specific roadless rule would look like. They could take no action, like many in this audience hope. On the other end of the spectrum, they could exempt the whole Tongass from the federal roadless rule, opening the door for development. But what's also possible are middle ground options. This committee is exploring a menu of new stipulations for mining, timber, transportation, renewable energy development, and more. The committee meets in Sitka through November 8th. They'll continue to develop these options and submit their report to Governor Walker by November 30th. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Fall whaling concluded in Ukiavik in late October and was characterized this year by events that brought both additional excitement but also sorrow to a usually celebratory time for the community. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig was in Ukiavik for the end of the whaling season and has this story.
It's early evening a few days after the last whale has been brought on shore in Ukiavik, and Ross and Justina Wilhelm's house is crowded with about 20 friends and relatives. They're setting out donuts and pineapple cake, arranging plates of whale meat and unalak, which is boiled whale blubber and skin, and bagging up servings of whale for people to take home.
Okay, and then if the muktuk is small, you guys need to put two, please.
Two muktuk, if it's small.
Ross Wilhelm is a whaling captain, and his crew, with help from others, brought in the final whale of the season. His wife, Justina, is responsible for organizing tonight's cruise serving, an event where anyone in the community can come get a portion of the whale. When everything is ready, the group joins hands and prays. Ross's mother, Laku Kanungnana, says the prayer in Inupiaq, expressing gratitude for the whale they're about to serve. The prayer is broadcast over VHF radio, along with the family's house number and an announcement that they're ready to serve. Soon there's a steady stream of people revolving through the house, yelling congratulations and trading hugs in the Wilhelm's living room.
Hi, how are you?
Ross Wilhelm spends the evening shaking hands and greeting visitors.
It's just what puts us together is the whale, the bowhead whale. Just gets us all together. Hi, John.
Thanks for coming here. Yes.
Wilhelm says that the usual energy around fall whaling was boosted this year, coming off a big success at the meeting of the International Whaling Commission in September. At that meeting, the IWC made some key changes to the bowhead whale quota that Alaska subsistence hunters had been pushing for. But on the other end of the emotional spectrum, the community just experienced a profound loss. About a month ago, Captain Roxy Oyagok Jr. and crew member Ron Kenierik were killed in a whaling accident off the coast of Utqiagvik when their boat capsized while towing a whale to shore. Ross Wilhelm says that the crew serving is a time of joy, and that seems to be the main emotion in the room during the event. But in conversations around town, it's clear there's still a lot of pain related to the accident. It's also an important reminder of something that whalers already know well, that whaling can be dangerous. Wilhelm says that he was shaken by what happened.
I'd look make myself look bad if I said it doesn't scare me, you know, because I'd be stupid if I didn't say that, you know, like of course it does.
Despite what happened this season and a close call he himself had in the past, Wilhelm isn't deterred from the hunt. He says sometimes things happen that are outside your control, but the only thing you can do is renew your vigilance when it comes to basic safety.
Steer left, steer right, stay straight, you know, watch the stern, watch the bow.
He's not the only one thinking along these lines. The Barrel Whaling Captains Association is reviewing what happened and will be discussing what safety lessons may be drawn from the accident at upcoming meetings. That's according to Crawford Putkatuk, a whaling captain and board member. He says that many in the community are still mourning the loss of the two men, but the overarching dedication to continuing the tradition of whaling remains strong.
For the most part, our people are able to rebound and continue our life, our culture, and knowing that Roxy and Ron would have it no other way. They would want us to continue our culture.
Fall whaling concluded in Utqiagvik with hunters bringing in a total of 19 whales, the full number of whales permitted by their quota. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Utqiagvik.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnosis and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. Did you know a single person who makes less than $60,720 per year may be eligible for federal tax credits to help pay health insurance premium costs? If you need health insurance for 2019, you have a limited time to sign up. Open enrollment for 2019 plans is just 6 weeks from November 1st through December 15th. Nobody can predict when they will have an accident or get really sick. If you don't have coverage, it could be financially devastating. Protect your future and sign up at healthcare.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
A roughly 9,000-year-old tooth found in Alaska is part of new research published recently in the journal Science. It came from a child, part of a group of ancient Beringians that crossed into Alaska from Asia across the Bering Land Bridge. The tooth itself has taken quite a journey. After it was initially found more than seven decades ago, the tooth sat in storage in Denmark. That was until Fairbanks-based National Park Service archaeologist Jeff Rasick found it. Rasick joins me now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
So tell me about this tooth. How did you find it?
I first learned about the tooth reading a technical report. It was written by a graduate student in this site from where the tooth comes. It's called Trail Creek Caves.
Did I read that you actually were in Copenhagen and came across the tooth?
Yeah, I was interested in this collection, which is in Copenhagen. One of my goals was to see if I could actually find this tooth. In a repository in an old museum like that, it's always a question of whether you can actually find a specimen like this.
I read that it's a part of broader research, but that the tooth itself is kind of interesting for some particular reasons, and maybe you could tell me about that.
It was totally loaded with information. We could tell a group of dental anthropologists looked at the tooth, and based on its shape, they could tell the age of the individual. Turned out to be a a young child. We had a group of researchers from the University of Alaska Fairbanks and University of Ottawa look at the isotopes, the chemical isotopes in the tooth. They were able to reconstruct the diet of this individual and the child's mother, in fact. And then we also dated the tooth directly. It was pivotal to understand the age of the spine.
That's just amazing to have something in your hand, right? You actually held this thing?
I did actually hold the sample when I was in Copenhagen. Yeah, it's a thrill to hold something like that in your hand that by some miracle survived the ravages of time. It's a small specimen. It's pretty unassuming, and it was in a vial. I did hold it in my hand, but I wore latex gloves. We knew that looking at ancient DNA was one of the possibilities here, so we were careful to handle this thing.
I can only imagine. And, you know, it sort of strikes me that we hear Alaska Natives have been in this place, on this land, for thousands of years, and to have direct evidence of that going back 9,000 years. I wonder what you think about that, to have put your hands on this with latex gloves, this evidence of that.
Yeah, I think that's one of the major points of this, the really deep and ancient roots that Alaska Native people have here. It's something we all know. It's something we've all heard. But when you see this really tangible evidence of it, it has even more impact. I can't take a lot of credit for finding something that was on a shelf. But, you know, the one thing I did through the project was communicate with the community. The village of Deering is located just a few dozen miles from this cave. And in fact, using that same cave that people around there know about and at times use today, they duck out of the weather and if they're in hunting in that area. Residents of Deering discovered the site. They knew of these caves back in the 1920s and probably much earlier than that. And it's a place that the local residents know about, and it was always essential to involve them in the process. That was one of the things they were very interested to know about and affirm, is that really long history of people in the area.
That was Fairbanks-based National Park Service archaeologist Jeff Rasick, who worked with University of Alaska Fairbanks researcher Matthew Wooler and University of Ottawa researcher Clement Bataille. Thanks for being here, Jeff.
Thank you. That was a lot of fun.
In Anchorage Public Libraries, a new series of teen open mics draws young performers from all kinds of genres. Teens come to sing, dance, play instruments, and recite poetry. As Alaska Public Media's Kirsten Swan reports, those performances share a few common chords.
15-year-old Nikita Eidelman has been playing the ukulele for a few years now. So when she learned about the monthly teen open mic sessions that take place in the wide open atrium of the Lusac Library, she was ready.
I've been wanting to share my singing and music for a while, and this was an opportunity, so I took it.
When she steps up to play in front of the big picture windows in the library atrium, she's standing in front of family members, passing library patrons, customers in line at the library cafe, and a few other teens waiting to perform.
Let's say we up and left this town and turned our future upside down.
She says singing here makes her feel like she's flying.
Like, you're not in a plane or anything, you're just out there and people can see you and hear you. And it's really amazing, really. I loved it.
The open mic sessions kicked off this summer as a way to give teens a place to practice performing in front of a live audience.
And since we know that dreams are dead and life turns plans up on their head.
Sometimes there are 3 or 4 or 5 performers. Sometimes nobody shows up. But teen librarian John Ebron comes and sets up the speakers every month because there aren't a lot of other opportunities like this around here.
Anchorage doesn't really have anywhere for teens to perform for teens to perform outside of a school program that I know of.
He says the open mic afternoons at the library are a safe place for teens to express themselves and get creative. For young people like Gloria Arnett, that's really important. She says she's faced everything from homelessness to bullying at school. Music is her escape.
It'll put me in my own little world of like, hey, you don't need those people. You don't need to listen to them. You're confident. You're beautiful. You're not who they say that you are. They only look on the outside, not in the inside.
She's performed at the library open mics before, but today might be one of the last times she sings here.
Sorry if I go off key.
The event is open to ages 12 through 18, and Gloria is about to turn 19. So when she takes the mic, she makes every note count.
I heard there was a secret chord that David played, and it pleased the Lord.
Gloria says she dreams about starting a record label, getting discovered, representing Alaska. The library is a step along the way. For aspiring young performers, it's a place to be seen and heard.
I swear she's destined for the stream. Closest thing to Michelle Pfeiffer that you've ever seen. Oh, and
John Ebron, the teen librarian, says that's the best part about these afternoon open mics.
For me, what I think is really important is just making it available and possible for those who choose to come and experience it.
If performing is like flying, this is the runway. For Alaska Public Media, I'm Kirsten Swan.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Nat Herz, Elizabeth Harbaugh, Andrew Kitchenman, and Kirsten Swan in Anchorage, Enrique Perez de la Rosa and Emily Kwong in Sitka, and Ravenna Koenig in Ukiagvik. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Alaska Startup Week is November 12th through the 18th, featuring events in 9 communities across the state. The week brings entrepreneurs, local leaders, and community members together. More at alaska.startupweek.co. This message is sponsored by Alaska Startup Week.
Support for Alaska Public Media comes from Raven, Alaska. Alaskans can maximize the holidays with The Day Over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination. More information can be found at ravendayover.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska wants to remind residents that open enrollment for individual and family health plans is now through December 15th. Many Alaskans qualify for a tax credit on their premiums, and studies from CMS indicate 90% of Alaskans qualified for a tax credit in 2017 to help lower the cost of coverage. Learn more and estimate your tax credit at Primera.com. This message sponsored by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.